Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. We've been incredibly fortunate over the last 4 years on the Money Maze podcast to have conversations with some of the most important former military leaders in the West, General Petraeus, General Sir Nick Carter, Lieutenant General Sir Tom Beckett, as we weigh geostrategic issues that directly impact the investing world. And today we have the huge pleasure and privilege to welcome General Sir Patrick Sanders, who until last month served as the Chief of the General Staff. And for those who are less familiar, that essentially is the head of the army and probably, by my calculations, less than a 0.1% chance when you started of reaching that position. So Patrick, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thanks, Simon.
Well, today is a first, as the interview is taking place from Salcombe in Devon, that well-known capital of finance, where General Sanders has come and he came on his motorbike. Now, even I recognise that the Money Maze podcast may not be a sufficient magnet to draw you here, Patrick. And in truth, you are in the areas you're receiving your honorary doctorate from Exeter University. You have also let me know, however, that you never finished your university degree. Just why was that?
Probably simply I didn't do enough work. I was there. I mean, it was worse than that because I was there on a army cadetship. So the army was paying the university fees and paying me. And I spent too much time having fun and not enough time working. I mean, the only reason I think that they've given it to me, and I had this lovely letter from the Vice Chancellor inviting me to accept an honorary doctorate. And I wrote back saying, look, to save us all some embarrassment, you might want to check your records because you'll find that I was thrown out and I'm your least distinguished undergraduate. And she replied going, oh, no. We know. We've really checked. And there was a long debate about this. So I think it's a story of redemption and how you can use failure for your advantage.
Great. Well, we might come back to some of those themes later on. But the aim today is to listen to your perspectives on the top geopolitical issues on the minds of politicians, populations, and the planet. Russia and assessing what is next. China. Is a modus operandi of peaceful coexistence possible? Iran, Israel, and the Middle East, and can we see a brighter future? Cyber, skills, leadership preparation, technology, imperatives, and the role of AI. And my job is to try and extract some of the investment ramifications from those points. But let's fall back first to a young Patrick Sanders. Was yours a family where service to your country and the idea of duty were discussed?
Yeah, my dad was serving. So like so many soldiers, you get used to following the flag. It was kind of in the blood. I lost two great uncles during the First World War. So I'm sort of third generation serving. And I loved it. I loved the life. And it was what I wanted to do.
But you came to a dinner that we had with Nicolai Tangen, head of the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, only a few months ago. And then we suddenly became aware that, in fact, you're half Norwegian.
Yeah, it's my mother tongue. So my mother's Norwegian. And like many First World War legacy families, I have very small amounts of family here in the UK. But every generation has five children in Norway. So I have more cousins than you can shake a stick at. So Norway is very much home.
Right. Well, as I did my research and I saw your journey, I had to smile because many years ago I applied for a commission with the Royal Green Jackets and did my regular commissions board, exams with them successfully, although I didn't pursue it. But I then smiled because I thought that A, I might actually have been your boss for a while because I am older, and B, on the basis of merit, it wouldn't have lasted very long.
No, I'm only here because all the good people left.
You saw action all over the world, and you got your Distinguished Service Order along with many other, you know, commendations. And I guess that before we talk about these geopolitical hotspots, when you get to the very top, you've gone from being a soldier to an advisor to governments, you're thinking about strategy, planning, execution. Just give us a sense of what it's like to have that position.
It's intellectually fascinating because the direction of military operations in war is one of the most complex human activities I think it's possible to undertake. I mean, just trying to get your head around the complexity of the strategic context and the environment is pretty tricky. And being a chief, being the head of the service, means you're effectively responsible for two things. One is for the health of the service, making sure that you're providing the military capability that the country needs. And that is about budgets. It's about procurement. It's about managing people. You know, that's institutional health. And then the other responsibility is providing military strategic advice to the government of the day through the Defense Secretary. And that is where you draw on, in my case, 40 years of deep professional study, a lot of professional military education, and of course, the experience that you accumulate along the way, which in my case ranged from, you know, the Cold War when I joined, through to interventions in the Balkans, and then of course the so-called GWAT years, you know, multiple tours in Iraq, including in 2003 when we first went in, which was a fascinating, though rather depressing experience, and then latterly Afghanistan. And now we're back to where we started, where after a, if you like, a 40-year holiday from history, history's returned with a vengeance.
Well, we're going to talk about that because you've been fairly clear and vocal that this is as dangerous as a time, if not more dangerous than even sort of the late 1930s. And I want to unpick that. But let's just start with Russia. After 2 years, Russia has not succeeded in defeating a small country. They've had a coup. They've had a lot of people trying to dodge the draft. And although I am no military expert, they've advanced but seem unable to surge forward. So there has been various reports, Reuters being one of them, that there is an appetite on behalf of Vladimir Putin to have a conversation. Give us a sense of who wants a deal.
I mean, we need to see this war for what it is, which is not simply about territory, but it's an existential struggle for the values and interests of liberal democracy and, if you like, Enlightenment principles. And what we have, it's not just Russia, we have, if you like, a new axis of four powers, so China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, who are testing the proposition that might is right. And what that's doing is not simply to fundamentally undermine our values and the order that's kept us safe, but it's also undermining global cooperation at a time when arguably we've never needed it more. When you consider some of the challenges that we face as a race, as a human race, whether that's climate change or whether it's the advent of some extraordinarily disruptive technologies. So if you focus in on Russia, I mean, Russia's war aim is nothing less than the subjugation of Ukraine and of Kyiv. And Russia is an expansionist imperial power. Its purpose, its aim is to dominate its near abroad and to occupy or control what it describes as historic Russia, which is much larger than the current borders of Russia as we would see it. And it sees the existence of Western institutions and all that we hold dear, so institutions like the EU and NATO, as an existential threat to Russia. And it will not stop. So it is very difficult when you see it in those terms, and there is almost a racial quality to what's going on in Ukraine, that it's very, very difficult to see where you can strike a deal, because any kind of deal is likely only to be a temporary pause, or you deliver Putin what he wants, which is essentially surrender. And the consequences of surrendering are not just terrible for Ukraine, but they fundamentally will undermine Western security, the security of the Euro-Atlantic area, and of course, it will give succor and encourage autocrats and dictators around the world who don't hold to our value system. There is this sort of assumption that all wars end in talking. I mean, it's not true. And in many wars end in surrenders or they end in ceasefires. You know, you could point to the Falklands War as an example, or the Second World War. So I'm not saying that talking isn't helpful, talking isn't necessary, but it's very difficult to see how you can reconcile those absolute and extreme war aims that Russia has with what we can live with and what certainly what Ukraine can live with. So we should at the moment be making sure that Ukraine can win. And that is not simply about surviving on the battlefield, which is arguably all we've been doing at the moment. It is about posing unacceptable threats to Russia, which causes Russia and Putin to reconsider. And there's a number of pressure points that you can pull on. So Russia will be first and foremost most concerned about its capacity to have sufficient conventional deterrence against NATO, not just nuclear deterrence. Its economy will weaken over time, and we can exploit domestic frustration in Russia. Now, none of that will happen quickly, but it will happen. And for all the reasons you point to, you know, this was the year where Russia needed to break through, and they haven't. You know, they have been gaining ground incrementally. It's become a war of attrition, but they haven't had a decisive breakthrough. I think they've taken something like 512 square kilometers in 6 months at a cost of about 120,000 casualties. You know, that is not decisive. And there's no sign at the moment that they've got the competence to be able to break through decisively.
Their one asset is unlimited manpower, because they'll be coerced, forced in a way that would be very familiar to Stalin. And they're not progressing, as you've just described. Other ambitions of moving up towards the Baltics, etc. Is that sort of, would that be plan B were they to have had success?
No, I mean, the it's a terrible thing to say, but Ukraine is buying us time and keeping Russia weak. So I don't believe that Russia has got the capability to do more than it is doing at the moment in Ukraine. But if and when this war stops, on whatever terms, Russia will recapitalize its armed forces. It will re-equip. That'll take 2 or 3 years to do. So depending on who you listen to, the estimate is that between 5 and 10 years, and Russia will be posing the sort of threat it was able to represent before Ukraine. And I think, you know, hold in mind that thing that I said about what Russia's view of the West is. It views us as an existential threat. And so they will see this as being at war with the West. It's just the tempo, the level of that war, the means they use will vary. And I think they're likely to seize opportunities if they arise. So the best way to prevent that from happening is to deter it.
So for the West to win, it has to play the long game.
Yes. Yeah. So time is on our side, not on Russia or Putin's side. You know, Russia will only get weaker. It's already more and more isolated. Its economy will get weaker. But we do need to hold our nerve and hold firm. And a Ukrainian win is a Western win.
And those of us who are so far removed, just try to understand Putin's mind. There was a story last week about the CEO of Rheinmetall, the largest ammunition manufacturer, you know, possibly being targeted by Russian proxies. And then I guess US and Germany have announced deployments of longer range missiles in Germany starting 06, and Moscow vowed a military response. How far is Putin prepared to go?
Well, what we're seeing Russia do is consistent with what Russia and the Soviet Union have always done. They don't view warfare in sort of binary terms in the way we do. They will use any and all means to subvert, to weaken, to undermine adversaries, which can include everything from assassinations and sabotage, and arguably we're seeing some of that going on at the moment, to exploiting deniable activity in, for example, the cyber domain, where they will either try and steal data or they will conduct attacks to undermine our infrastructure and our secrets, through to interfering with undersea cables, which we're so reliant on. So this is a pattern of behavior that is consistent with Russian doctrine and with Soviet doctrine before it. I think in some respects, we have overestimated how Russia will respond to our support to Ukraine. In some respects, we've been deterring ourselves because we have allowed the Russians to gain what you might call escalation dominance, where we've held back from the sort of decisive levels of support that we could have given Ukraine early on for fear of what the Russians would do. And yet, rather like a boiling frog, each time a threshold is reached where the Russians have said they would respond, they haven't.
Got it. So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. Schroders is a leading provider of active asset management, advisory and wealth management services, recognized as a leader in sustainability. Few investment managers can match the combination of capabilities and global reach that Schroders offer. Across public and private markets, Schroders offers distinctive investment solutions for the diverse needs of wealth, pension and insurance clients and the other owners of long-term assets, providing excellent long-term investment outcomes when Schroders succeeds for clients, society and the wider world benefit too. So let's march south of the Middle East. No Arab country came to the support of Hamas, as I understand it, and there is a sense, talking to various constituencies, that the goal of the Arab world is stability and the continuation of the Abraham Accords, with the exception of Iran. Just give us a sense of how you diagnose it.
I mean, I think you have it right. Ultimately, the goal of the Arab world and the states, and the Gulf states, is essentially what any country wants, which is a combination of stability, regional stability, and internal political stability, security and prosperity. And as you say, that meant that they were very happy, indeed keen, to strike up a relationship with Israel through the Abraham Accords. So that gives you a sense of what it is that they're after. I think it's important that we avoid trying to push or force the Gulf states and the Arab world into choosing sides and into push them into blocks. But there's no doubt that in the region at the moment, Palestine, the issue of Palestine, has re-emerged as the fulcrum on which everything pivots. And the prize, if we can achieve it, is Palestinian statehood, domestic stability for the Arab states out there, greater prosperity, and a marginalized Iran. The risk, and I think this is the more likely outcome at the moment, is that we end up with a regional conflict that involves Lebanon and Hezbollah, of course, one of Iran's, perhaps Iran's most important proxy, the Houthis, another proxy, albeit not very controllable by Iran, and then a direct clash between Iran and Israel itself. And the consequences of that, both for the regional, but also for energy and for capital flows around the world, is really grim. And so threading a course through that is going to be really tricky.
And let's just laser in on Iran. I think it was the Henry Jackson Society who advocated carrying out strikes on Iran to counter their activities. We know that the whole process of rapprochement around the Gulf states and Israel is absolute anathema to Iran. How would you respond, if it was you solely in charge, to the Iranian threat?
So I think it's important to try to avoid the sort of direct confrontations that will catalyze regional conflict. I was lucky enough to spend quite a lot of time in Iran before the revolution as a child. And, you know, my memory of Iran is of a great civilization, wonderful people, an amazing country. But that civilization sort of feels lost at the moment. You know, any state whose unifying idea is death to America and death to Israel on the back of a theocracy is going to be hard to see as anything other than a threat that needs to be contained. And there was, with the nuclear deal that we had, the so-called JCPOA, an opportunity to contain Iran as a threshold nuclear power, but not crossing that threshold, and over time to moderate its disruptive behavior in the region and create that time. So for me, any approach to Iran needs to be one of containment, you know, confrontation where we need to, but buy ourselves time.
And a question actually from a former colleague of mine at Morgan Stanley, Eric Scott, says, how do we assess Iran's power and influence?
Well, it's weak economically. It is for a proportion of Shia Islam an important religious or moral authority. It has got very, very usable hard power in the sense that it's created this extraordinary network of proxies, the most powerful of which is Hezbollah, but also Hamas and the Houthis, which has been very disruptive regionally. But none of that sort of usable hard power actually translates into the sort of hard power that they can use once you get into a direct confrontation and a clash. So for Iran, it is much more desirable to remain, you know, they want to avoid a clash with Israel. They want to avoid a clash with the United States, because once conflict breaks out into the open, actually some of their natural advantages fall away.
And when one has seen the youthful and the female rebellion against the theocratic powers and maybe naively thought that this is galvanizing a sort of a new spring, are others all essentially illusory? And if you have a state-controlled sort of apparatus as the Tehran, they just are, they're fires that are put out.
I think it's very hard to tell. Most political change, most change in Iran is violent. And so we can expect a return to that cycle. But it's also true that the theocracy has laid very deep roots, and that the deep state of Iran is really represented by the IRGC, and rather like a cockroach. Even if you saw the fall of a theocracy, a shift to a different form of government, a more moderate government, I think we should be realistic and expect that the IRGC will survive and play an enduring role. So patience, strategic patience, deterrence, containment, and avoiding the sort of conflict that could break out feels crucial.
So playing the long game seems to be a theme we've had now with the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Middle East and Iran. Let's, of course, turn to China. I think it was General Sonny Carter, as a guest on the show, described as the chronic challenge. How do we think about peaceful coexistence, given that, again, we have antithetical regimes?
Well, I think our goal, peaceful coexistence would be nice. I think it's more likely to be competitive coexistence, breaking out occasionally into confrontation, but hopefully never conflict. But I mean, let's be clear, the planet needs China. You know, we need China because China will be key to tackling some of the really great challenges that we faced. So what's the first of those? I mean, energy transition. We think that China's development of renewable technologies will be world leading. And we want to tap into that. We want them to play a role. We think China will be absolutely crucial to managing the impact of what are arguably the most transformational technologies that we will ever see. So artificial intelligence and synthetic biology, because the consequences of not managing the introduction of those technologies safely is potentially almost existential. And then China is key to trying to find a way of preserving the global commons. So trying to find areas where we can collaborate with China is something that we should absolutely pursue. But there are some real risks at the moment. And I think it was best expressed as trying to avoid falling into the Thucydides trap. You know, this notion of a rising power confronting a status quo power, in this case, the US. And when you've got a rising and an expansionist power that is seeking, and not illegitimately, to rewrite the rules of the game to suit itself, then that's got some of the seeds for confrontation. And there are three real risks, I think, that we're facing. The first is that I think China is convinced that the US wants to prevent its rise, the rise of China, in all circumstances. So that it is impossible to see, it becomes zero sum. Secondly, China's economy is slowing. Thirdly, China, the CCP are, their greatest concern, their greatest fear is about the loyalty of the people, and they can't assume that that will always be there. And then there is a risk that Taiwan becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And rather like we found in the build-up to the First World War, where you had a rising power, Germany, and a status quo power, the British Empire, then the inevitability of territorial expansion and something like the Schlieffen Plan led you to miscalculation and then conflict. The same thing could occur with Taiwan. So I think, you know, we handle China through engagement by finding common cause on issues like climate change, you know, possibly like the emergence of AI. You know, we avoid trade wars, we avoid confrontations, we behave steadily and predictably. We develop, we sustain, we maintain this network of minilateral alliances and arrangements that we have in the Indo-Pacific. And one of the ways that you might unlock this and to give a Xi and the CCP a sense that they don't need to rush into a miscalculation is to reaffirm the Shanghai Declaration, just reaffirm this notion of the one China policy, because then you're not forcing this artificial deadline of 2027 or 2050 or whatever one they take.
Just explain that again, because I'm not sure I'm familiar with that Shanghai Declaration.
So I'm hoping that I got this right. One of the most significant points of agreement was this notion that we recognize a one China policy. And that just buys you a bit more time.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description below. Now, we've talked about these regional hotspots. I think that we might sometimes look at Korea as a maverick, but a minor player in all this. You mentioned it at the outset. We know it's sort of, you know, it's couldn't be more opposed to the values that the West stands for. I mean, how much should we worry about Korea as the least predictable actor?
North Korea always feels like one of those low likelihood, very high impact threats or events. I guess what we should be worried about is that where previously most of North Korea's effort was focused on defending North Korea and defending the regime, it's now growing capabilities that give it offensive capability. And once you start shifting from being a defensive to an offensive power, then you have potentially a lot of scope for miscalculation. And where North Korea was previously extraordinarily isolated, really its only friend, and then a pretty reluctant one, was China. The war in Ukraine has opened up the prospects and the opportunity for other client relationships, and of course, Russia being one. So you now have this alignment of aims and this increasing integration of war economies between Russia and North Korea, but also Iran and China. And that's why I use this descriptor of the Axis powers. You know, they are actually more aligned than the original Axis powers were in World War II. So you can't take your eye off North Korea, and containing and deterring that threat is key.
Now, again, we are guilty, I think, in the West, and it was, I think, Peter Frankopan who used that expression of we in the West have our eyes stitched closed, but you travel and have traveled in your role extensively. We have the Global South sitting on the fence in some of these conflicts. Incredibly important populations and economies and central to Western prosperity, both from an investing and a consumption standpoint. How do you reflect on, you know, those big countries?
So it's a very broad label, isn't it? The Global South. It's one that I'm sort of reluctant to use, but it's, you know, it's good shorthand. This return to an age of competition that we've seen emerging is really caught between three blocks. The West, trying to drag the present back into the past. The emerging autocracies who want to rewrite the rules of the game. And then the rest, what you describe as the Global South, who want to preserve some choice, some strategic autonomy, and not get dragged into one of the blocks. And I think it's important that we don't force these emerging powers, because they are crucial, into having to make choices that they, or indeed we, will regret. And for me, this comes down to the power of persuasion. So, you know, it's quite a few of the Global South have found that it's been in their interests for a variety of reasons to align themselves or to exploit the opportunities that have come from the Belt and Road Scheme that China have offered, and sort of investment without any conditions or conditionality. And in some cases, we should welcome that. You know, in my case, in Pakistan, the CPEC, the corridor, has been good for Pakistan's economy. And where Pakistan has been, I think, quite wise is it hasn't allowed itself to cede control and cede its sovereignty to China. So it's drawn the benefits from Chinese investment without being completely inhocked or enslaved by China in a way that others perhaps have risked doing. You know, what is it that we offer? We should be offering consistency, reliability, you know, the values that the West have espoused. Because if you live in the Indo-Pacific in particular, on the one hand, these countries can see the benefits of trading with China and want to. But on the other hand, they really don't like and resent the sort of aggressive territorial expansion and undermining of the rules-based system, and in particular, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea that we're seeing in, you know, places like the South China Sea. And so giving Indo-Pacific countries choice, options, ensuring that they don't get captured into a particular block has to be what we should look for.
So as these conflicts bubble, there are some important investment themes. We've touched on them, guns, ammunition. But at the root of all military conflict historically is that war spurs innovation, and innovation is most seen in technology. We've seen private equity firms aligning with the defense community. Just give us a sense of, where is change happening? Is it as simple as we need more shells and we need more bullets and we need more guns?
Well, it's both, isn't it? The initial investments need to go into the sort of things that are going to make us capable of deterring Russia during this decade, because there is a risk that an alignment of ending the war in Ukraine, Russian recapitalization, and China saying that the PLA needs to be ready to invade Taiwan by 2027 creates a point of acute danger to in around about 2028 or so. And the best way to ensure that we avoid that is ensuring we're ready to fight and therefore able to deter and prevent these conflicts from happening in this decade. That doesn't answer your question about where the emerging technologies are, but it is an important thing to say that if we don't regrow what are very, very empty stockpiles at the moment and recapitalize, then we risk making conflict an inevitability. But what we are seeing, as you say, because war is such an accelerant, we are seeing extraordinarily pace of developments in economy, in capabilities that are essentially enabled by the digital transition. And of course, the most significant of those is around how we use data and how we exploit artificial intelligence. And, you know, if you want a more relatable example, the evolution of GPT, so from GPT-2, which was basically a sort of common interest standard student, to GPT-4 in what, only 4 years, and GPT-4, you know, takes you almost to university graduate level, is an extraordinary evolutionary leap. It's almost revolutionary, that level of development. And so harnessing the power of AI across all functions of our economy, you know, all of the opportunities is going to be key. But where perhaps we've seen some of the most progress has been on the battlefield. So at the start of this war, drones were pretty dumb. I think during the course of this year, we will see swarming drones, not pre-programmed, but able to cooperate dynamically. And then we are not far off from having swarming drones operating completely autonomously without needing any human input. And that includes potentially, or the option of not having humans involved in targeting. Now, that is an extraordinary evolution. I'm not saying it's something we should pursue, but that is where the technology will take you if you don't intervene and you don't begin to focus on it.
So significant investments in the whole of the defense armaments support systems, but allied to that is dealing with the cyber threats that emerge? And just give us a sense for, because again, on a daily basis, people in the West and elsewhere probably are not aware of just how profound and regular these threats are. Is that the right description, number one? And number two, how do we even start to calibrate the risks and the responses?
Yeah, I don't think you're overstating the challenge that the threats in the cyber domain present. There are a variety of things going on all at the same time. So at the low end, and this is where we all feel it most acutely, you simply have bad behaviors online, you know, harms, you have criminality, but you've also got espionage, you've got sabotage going on, and then crucially, you've got disinformation. And of all of those, and when, you know, when we think about cyber through a Hollywood lens, we tend to think of cyber attacks as the ability to turn off a power plant, to close down a gas pipeline, you know, these sort of traditional acts of sabotage. And it is possible to do those things. It takes a lot of planning and effort, but it is possible to do it. But I think much more insidious and much more harmful, and possibly the most acute short-term threat that we face, and I think it was Antonio Guterres who described this threat as almost existential. He might be overstating it a little bit. But the idea that you can, particularly when it's powered by AI, create disinformation that fundamentally undermines people's faith in the institutions that govern us, that corrupts, that poisons democracy, where you simply can't believe what you're seeing and you don't know what to trust. So disinformation, I think, is the greatest and the most significant risk that we face. And it requires cooperation with the big tech companies who are beginning to regulate themselves more effectively, but it is also going to require intergovernmental cooperation as well.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more, or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market. So, you, as I discovered on my travels, seem to know more people than I could have imagined, and so many had questions for you today. So some of them might class themselves as friends. Now, whether they are after I've asked you their questions is another matter. But in fact, Peter Frankopan, who I just mentioned, former guest, professor of global history in Oxford and author of The Great Silk Roads, had a question which is, reflecting back on your long and distinguished career, what do you wish you'd been told at the outset that you've had to learn the hard way?
So Peter has a habit of asking difficult questions. I wish that I had developed a specialization more early. I've been a generalist. So I've either worked on operations or I've worked at the military strategic level. But where I think I could have put a lot more effort in early on was developing an understanding of the power of technology and in particular coding.
Well, the next question, which is from Major General Simon Lawler, formerly of the HAC like me, except he advanced and I did not, is that he observed, and you have been Colonel Commandant of the HAC as well. So in fact, for those who don't know, HAC is the Honourable Artillery Company, which is a territorial regiment. He says land warfare was ditched after the Berlin Wall came down. We've had years of neglect. How long will it take to reestablish excellence?
We are excellent. I wouldn't wish people to go away thinking that the British Armed Forces and the British Army aren't excellent. We are a reference army for good reason. And the quality of our people, because we train them so effectively, the quality of our leadership, the quality of our NCOs are amongst the best in the world. But what I think Simon is talking about is that we are now effectively operating with legacy equipment, so dial-up telephones in an iPhone age, and we need to modernize, and above all, we need to increase our lethality, and that's what my successor is most focused on. And we need to ensure that we can operate at scale. So that means regrowing our stockpiles, but also ensuring that the army, which is historically very, very small at the moment, in an era where we are facing a return to great power conflict is capable of being grown rapidly, and we need to lay those foundations in place. All of that, I would say, will take us between 5 and 10 years.
Which actually dovetails very nicely with a question from a gentleman who you know, Alistair Maxwell. I found myself playing golf with him a couple of weeks ago, former Green Jacket and partner at Goldman Sachs. And he says, at what size does the UK Army cease to be effective?
Well, the short answer for that is it depends on what you want it to do. It is arguably too small now. I said that when I took over a couple of years ago. And the force that we have committed to providing to NATO would be a lot easier to deliver out of a regular army that is closer to 82,000 than the 71 or so thousand that we have at the moment. The thing we should remember, though, is we always obsess about the size of the regular army. You know, as a total force, we should be about 130,000, because that's your regulars, it's your reserves, like the HAC, and then it's, of course, all of those of us regulars and reserves who remain liable for call-up after we've stepped away from uniform. And I think I've still got a couple of years of that before I'm off the books as well.
Now, Edward Watson, who kindly made the introduction, and I know Edward's wife, Helen Watson, because she looks after the Rothschilds Wealth Management business in the UK, he said, how do you reflect on that tricky interplay between the professional soldier class and the politicians with their ambitions?
So I think it was Elliot Cohen that described it as an unequal dialogue. And it's really important that that dialogue is unequal. I think what we can all take a lot of pride from is the way that we had the transition of power from the previous government to the current one, and the grace with which that played through and how effectively it's being done. So these democratic values, which includes civilian control of the armed forces, is really, really important. Now, dealing with politicians and with ministers is not always smooth. Our objectives are not always aligned. You know, politicians and governments are all about, or as much about getting re-elected as they are about governing. And so sometimes the short term trumps the longer term. And that's where I think probably the points of friction arise. But as a chief, and I've done two chief's jobs because I was doing strategic command before this, so a total of 5 years now sitting on the Chiefs of Staff Committee, I've found that by and large, our politicians are well-intentioned, and in particular, defense secretaries feel their responsibilities very acutely from the moment they assume the role.
The next question is from former colonel of the Argyles, Johnny Gray, and says, at what point does a cyber attack on our infrastructure become an act of war?
Johnny will know that NATO has said that a cyber attack could constitute a breach of Article 5. What we haven't done is to specify what kind of attack, what kind of effects would trigger Article 5. And I think when it comes to deterrence, ambiguity can be helpful. So put it another way, I can't remember which senator it was or Supreme Court judge in the US, but when asked how to define pornography, he says, you'll know it when you see it.
Well, that doesn't lead us on to our next question, but I spoke to Bear Grylls ahead of our conversation, who I didn't realize, but who told me you have appointed him Honorary Colonel of the Army Foundation College. He's written this book, Never Give Up, which is all about resilience. And his question was, how do you encourage, promote, grow resilience in an organization like the Army?
So I think we are pretty resilient, because what you find in military culture and in these extraordinarily tight, cohesive teams that we form is that there is an almost unique set of common values and a common purpose. Everyone's values, everyone's incentives are aligned the same way. And there is a sense of mission, of a higher purpose, if you like, that makes people work very, very closely together in tight teams, and therefore tends to make those teams quite resilient. But at an individual level, the stresses and strains of service life, whether it's being exposed to, you know, horrific acts of violence on operations, you know, which I've seen, whether it's the separation or just the compound effect of a variety of things going on, going wrong in your life can mean that people can be frail, people can be vulnerable. And one of the things that I've been very focused on, and I think, you know, actually the whole of the army has, is to get people to acknowledge that everybody is going to have bad days and bad periods in their life. Everybody is going to feel or suffer from some form of mental ill health sooner or later. And there are steps you can do to mitigate and prevent that. But equally, there is nothing wrong with putting your hand up to those people you trust and saying, I need a bit of help. And that was certainly the case with me. For what it's worth, and I think Bear has been brilliant at promoting that. And, you know, he's an exemplar of how to do it. And that's one of the reasons we asked him to take on the Foundation College at Harrogate.
Terrific. And we went to listen to his show that is going on around the UK right now, which a lot of it's built on resilience and is really, really inspiring for families. And I saw lots of young families and young boys and girls looking up, listening. And it was inspirational. Patrick, the closing questions, coming back to that idea of technology and its imperative, I just want to push you a little bit. Where are the specific areas where you think the biggest surprises might come from, or where the biggest application of resources should be directed?
It's got to be around data and software and digital, because producing hardware takes a long time, particularly when you're trying to ensure that that hardware is at the edge of the envelope, is cutting edge, is going to give you a competitive advantage. So building a ship, a submarine, a tank, an aircraft, these all take time. The competitive advantage will come from the data, how you exploit the data and the software. And so the shorthand answer will be, if we're not investing in very much more than we are at the moment, a more greater proportion of our budget in software and in developing safe AI, then we will fall behind, because our competitors and adversaries will develop AI and it won't necessarily be safe.
Trump or Kamala Harris, which would the West prefer?
So I don't want to express a preference because I don't think it's appropriate. Trump, I mean, difficult to tell if the tragic of events in Pennsylvania will change his approach. So drawing on what we saw of him before, and in particular, I listened to Fiona Hill, who's really good on this stuff. You know, Fiona has described the prospect of Trump 2.0 as being someone who is vengeful, who is unconstrained because he now knows how to govern and will surround himself with people who will agree with him rather than try to temper and moderate him. He's not someone who is necessarily motivated by freedom or democratic values or is attached to the rules-based international order. His instincts are mercantilist. He's egoistic. And he sees allies not always as partners, but more frequently as trade adversaries to be punished or competed with. So that approach to international affairs could, at its most extreme, begin to spell the end of the West as the organizing principle in international relations. I think there are three particular risks with Trump that we will need to mitigate. The first is that his sort of unique brand of strongman nationalism creates a permissive environment for aggression globally and by leaders who admire his approach. I think secondly, the things he has said about rolling back US democracy, if it comes to pass, will undermine democracy and those sort of values globally. And I think the third risk is that America first, very competitive, zero-sum approach will undermine collaboration and cooperation in the international community at the very point where we need it most, particularly around climate change, green transition, and these emerging technologies. And I keep returning to it, but I think AI is the most exciting thing that's going to happen to us this decade. I think it will be this decade. But I also think that if we don't focus or put an enormous amount of effort into trying to mitigate the risks and develop safe AI internationally, then we will lose control of it.
Five non-military closing question. What's your most important daily habit?
Sleeping well.
What advice would you give for young people thinking about any number of careers?
Have any number of careers. That would be a good start. I'm a great fan of reinvention. And you will be if in doubt, embrace audacity. You know, the young have tremendous courage and are prepared to take risks that in later life feel scary. You'll achieve most by being bold.
Who would you really like to meet in the world who you're yet to?
A grandson. No pressure on my son.
No pressure on your son. That has not been an answer we've received in 153 interviews. So terrific. And what's the...
Or daughter, sorry.
Or daughter.
Grandson or daughter. Right. Daughter.
What's the unclimbed peak for you?
I think the area that fascinates me most at the moment, and now that I have more time, I'm able to focus on it, and I learned a lot about this when I was running Strategic Command, is around the emergence of AI. So I think, you know, I can clearly draw on quite a lot of experience around geopolitics and geostrategy, but the area that I really want to focus on is trying to help with the introduction of a safe testing regime of AI, because I think it's fascinating, because I think AI offers so much potential, but I also really worry that we won't understand the AGI, the AGI agents that will emerge potentially within this decade. And if we don't understand them, we won't be able to control them.
Well, that seems like a good place to stop, because I know I could ask you a lot more questions, which is why we may have to ask you back at some point. And when we had that dinner, I mentioned one of our podcast dinners with Nicolai Tangen from the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, you know, your presence was terrific to be able to join dots in the investment parlance that might not otherwise have been joined. I have written down a lot of things as conclusions. This Ukraine war has to be won by the West, and it's going to be a long war, and patience should be our friend. That the Middle East conflict has the possibility of a constructive solution, but we shouldn't be forcing some of the actors, particularly the Gulf states, into premature action. And that when we think about the term, which you have some reservations about, you know, but the global South, allowing them to weigh up the merits and demerits of their relationships and not wanting to be, in my words, overly dogmatic is, you know, is sounds pragmatic, but is also very important. And finally, for the young folks, of whom we have many at universities and at schools and others, about their career, if in doubt, embrace audacity. I like that. That's very good indeed. Patrick, thank you. You've come all this way down to Salcombe, which it turns out you know very well. It's fantastic to have you here. I think we're going to possibly offer you a little lunch as recompense. And just, you know, big thanks from all of us.